Today on Rocking the Suburbs.
I bought Holy Diver with my confirmation money. Welcome to day two of Black Sabbath Week here on Rockin' the Suburbs. Yesterday we spoke about the first five albums from Black Sabbath all the way through Sabbath Bloody Sabbath. Today we're going to talk about the next five albums, starting with the album Sabotage. My name is Mike Coley. I'm here with Mr. Stephen Routledge.
Hi, Mike. Great to be talking metal with you again, Mike.
Talking metal, baby.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's good stuff, eh? Yeah, so we'll just carry straight on from where we were yesterday. So we'd finished with a Sabbath Bloody Sabbath yesterday. That leads us into 1974, when there is, for the first time since 1970, we don't get a new Sabbath album. That's to come in 1975. But it is a significant year because the band at this point suddenly realised that they haven't got any money, or rather, their management has taken all their money.
All of their money.
All their money. And so the disentangling them from their management company there is something that takes a long time and a lot of lawsuits. And they sign with a new manager, a guy called Don Arden, who is known for good reason as the Al Capone of pop. He had wanted to sign Sabbath earlier, actually, and had missed out to the guys who they did go with, who had been proteges of Don Arden. And yeah, this is not hearsay, this is fact. You know, Don Arden was, you know, a nasty bit of work, and that will eventually catch up with him. But what he was the sort of person who could do was hopefully try and sort things out for Sabbath. And his priority was, because what in part of all the legal wranglings, they found out that they basically didn't own those first five albums. So all the stuff, all that classic metal just talked about, was really owned by the management company and not the band. So they signed with Don Arden, whose daughter is someone called Sharon, who at the time is working as a receptionist in her dad's office.
A little foreshadowing.
A little bit. And yes, Sharon will re-enter the story later on. But for the moment, yeah. So they signed with Don Arden, who is from the Peter Grant of Led Zeppelin School of Management, of basically hurt people if they don't give you what you want. So the sort potentially the sort of person you want to have on your side, but not a particularly nice guy. Let's leave it at that. And yeah, we shall get to more fallout from that later on. So Don gets them back in the studio, says, let's get a new album made, get it out there so you can start get something to actually start earning you some money. And obviously by extension make him some money as well. So the album Sabotage comes, the title name comes from all their legal wranglings, and there's a song on there called The Writ, because of all the legal writs they were getting served during the course of it, and some of that rage comes out in it. It's another terrible album cover, Mike.
Yeah, they definitely needed some help in the art department.
Yeah, although again, foreshadowing, it's not their worst album cover. But fortunately, the music contained therein is still pretty good, Mike.
Yes.
I mean, Hole in the Sky, Mastodon, and yeah, rest in power, Brent Hinds, who recently sadly died.
Yeah, terrible loss.
Yeah. Obviously, he'd recently left Mastodon, but Mastodon clearly heard Hole in the Sky and thought, yeah, we can work with that. you know, I'm not trying to do down Mastodon. I love Mastodon. But I'm just, there are so many other bands that have been influenced by Sabbath and different songs, and you can just take that and just build a whole career out of one Sabbath song, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We can't kind of overstate the influence, you know.
I think about Anthrax's cover of Sabbath, Bloody Sabbath. That's like my touchstone for Sabbath covers is that, for some, I don't know. I was a big Anthrax fan back in the day, so I think that's just their influence on so many different people, and the way that Anthrax tackled Sabbath, Bloody Sabbath, that really stuck with me over the years.
Well, I mean, certainly Scott Ian of Anthrax, when asked to name his top five metal albums, just said the first five Sabbath albums.
Yeah.
Which, you know, I can't quite go with that, but you can't go too wrong if that was all you had to go with, you know. You kind of get his point that it's like, well, here's the handbook. There you go. Those five albums. But what's your thoughts on Sabotage, Mike? Any particular ones that stand out to you?
The one that sticks out mostly, and probably for most people who are Sabbath fans, is probably Symptom of the Universe. I mean, it's just got the speed to it. It's got the cool riffs going on again, and it kind of foreshadows thrash a little bit.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, that's what I've got written down here. Proto thrash.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. Let's be more accurate. Symptom of the Universe, proto thrash banger.
Sums it up pretty succinctly.
Absolutely. But other than Paranoid, there's none of these songs that hits on, but it hasn't got maybe the songs that have leapt out immediately, stuff like War Pigs and that. Let's take a listen to Symptom of the Universe, and we'll keep talking about it a bit more. Just so good, just so good.
The drumming again.
Oh yeah, on the intro. Just great stuff. And obviously, again, sounding fantastic on that one as well.
You tell they're pissed off on this one.
Yes, the anger and the rage of the split with Patrick Meehan, who was there, the manager who basically took them to the cleaners for those first five. Albums, yeah, and people might think, well, how can they not have any money? But you got to remember, these are four working class guys from Birmingham. You know, they suddenly get albums in the charts, and they got money because the way it worked was the manager said, "Oh yeah, I want to buy a house," so he'd buy the house with their money, but they never actually had any sort of money themselves. He would buy, you know, the manager would buy things for them. So, the whole album is kind of fueled by the rage, you know. Yeah, we get more sort of other sounds as well. We get horns on Thrill of It All, which sounds a little bit like a Who song in some ways. But it's a strong album, apart from Am I Going Insane, which is not good.
Yeah, not too big a fan of that one.
I don't think any Sabbath fans are a fan of Kanye Saint Mike, are they? It's and I think it that the sort of the hints are there on this album, whilst it's still a strong album, it's not quite at the same level as what's come before. And I to me, you can the cracks are starting to appear, and the lifestyle, i.e., the drugs, is starting to catch up a little bit. And the bill is going to come due quite soon. but yeah, certainly, yeah. The first six Sabbath albums are considered, you know, the sort of the classic six for a reason, you know. And you know, if you've enjoyed any of the other Sabbath stuff, then you'll probably enjoy Sabotage, you know. But it wouldn't be the place to start. You know, there's better. It's a sort of notch down from those.
Yeah, it's definitely not as cohesive as the first five. It has some flourishes for sure. Hole in the Sky is pretty cool. But Symptom of the Universe is definitely the standout track on that one.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. No. And so it doesn't sell as well as what's gone previously, but it still sells pretty well, and they're still drawing massive, huge crowds, you know, particularly in the States when they're touring. But Tony, in particular, is because, I mean, the critics, I mean, it's something we didn't really cover to start with, but the critics hated Black Sabbath. Absolutely loathed them from the start. And Tony craved to be taken as seriously as Led Zeppelin and Deep Purple and the like. And that was, you know, whilst they did start to get some decent reviews starting with Sabbath Bloody Sabbath, you know, on the whole, the press were not kind to Black Sabbath, which when you're selling millions of records doesn't really matter, but but it was Tony was starting to get bothered by it, and he really felt that he wanted to sort of try and prove that he could do all the things that Jimmy Page could do, or the things that Ritchie Blackmore could do. And so after Sabotage, we get in 1976, we get the first compilation, We Sold Our Soul for Rock and Roll, which was put out by their previous management because, as we covered previously, Sabbath didn't own the rights to their first five albums.
That may have been my actual full intro to the Ozzy era of Sabbath, is this album, The Sabbath, or
The Collection, yeah.
Yeah, The Collection.
Yeah, which is, I mean, obviously, it's got loads of great stuff on there. It makes it, but how many people, I wonder, buying that at the time knew that basically the band were getting no money from that whatsoever?
Yeah, I feel guilty for loving that album as much as I did.
I know, it's pretty galling, isn't it? I mean, this is, yeah, this is, they needed a Taylor's version back in 1975. Tony's version. So as we mentioned before, they signed with Don Arden, who also had another band called ELO on his books, another Birmingham band who were starting to become successful at this time as well. And they go back into the studio to work on the next album, and they go to Miami to record this. The name of the studio has now escaped me briefly. But again, lots of recreational substances are consumed during the making of what becomes Technical Ecstasy. They hire a guy called Gerald Woodruff to play keys as part of the band, because there's a lot more synths and keyboard stuff coming into the sound of Technical Ecstasy, which perhaps in reaction to the previous album cover has a Hypnosis album cover, the guys who did a lot of the Pink Floyd and Yes stuff. You can kind of see where Tony's head's at with this and what he's trying to achieve. Ozzy hated the cover of this one, but it's better than the Sabotage cover, so, you know.
Yeah, no room to complain here, Oz.
But that's probably about the best thing you can say about this album, isn't it, Mike?
Yeah, yeah. This is kind of this is where a lot of people fell off. They're trying to do things. They're trying to keep up with the times, I think, a little bit. Because punk was taking over, and so they're, you know, they're trying to they get a song called Backstreet Kids that kind of sounds, you know, it's
I'm so getting a cold sweat, Mike.
Is it the attempt punk rock? Is it the attempt to have those types of lyrics?
I mean, yeah, and it's staggering to think. I mean, Geezer mentions this in his autobiography. He's like, they've already done punk rock. Paranoid is punk, as well as metal.
Yeah, you know, Geezer's written so many awesome lyrics up to this point. This song, I'm just another Backstreet Kid. Rock and roll music is the only thing I really dig.
Was this Kiss or something? What's going on?
Right? Yeah, that sounds like a Paul Stanley lyric right there. It's cringing. It's cringeworthy.
Yeah, I mean, I'll read you my notes on Technical Ecstasy, Mike. I said it's like Queen meets Led Zeppelin. The playing is actually decent, but it's not metal. And Tiny does some of his best solo work on this album. But to prove my point, and I have this quite often, I've used this multiple times in different scenarios. But one thing about the streaming services, they can often solidify your thoughts or prove you right about what you think about something. Because when something finishes, they normally cue something up next, like it, don't they?
Yeah.
So when I listened to Technical Ecstasy, my streaming service played, the next song it played after that finish was Every Mother's Son by Lynyrd Skynyrd. Which kind of proves my point that even the music providers don't think Technical Ecstasy is metal. I mean, the only positive thing you can say about this album is that the studio in Miami, where they're recording, the Eagles were next door recording Hotel California, and Sabbath was so loud that apparently the Eagles had to stop recording for a while.
That's good enough for me.
That's something, a positive we can take from this album. Although they also did say that the engineer had to basically take the mixing desk apart because after the Eagles left, there was so much coke in the sliders on the board that they wouldn't move. Which also kind of checks out. So, Mike, do we need to hear anything from Technical Ecstasy? Do the folks need to suffer, or should we just?
I think we can move on.
Well, so that takes us into 1977, and in my notes, I have that it says here 1977 that the journey begins. But not in a good way. So Technical Ecstasy, say, is not well received and doesn't sell anything like as much as the previous albums. They have a disastrous European tour with AC/DC, who are opening for them, and Geezer and Malcolm Young have a misunderstanding, let's say, in the bar, which ends up with AC/DC being kicked off the tour. Tony briefly fires Geezer, and then 3 weeks later, Geezer's back in the band. Ozzy at this point leaves. And they haven't got a singer. And so they recruit a guy called Dave Walker, who was in, I believe, Rancor Survived Brown, and was also from the same part of the world, but from Birmingham. That's how Tony knew him. They end up doing some TV performances with Dave Walker and start writing some songs for what will become the next album with him, before they realise that it's not quite working. Ozzy's doing interviews saying he's going to be forming a band called the Blizzard of Oz, and you know, he's not in Sabbath anymore. But they realise it's not working, and Ozzy comes back.
He was gone for what, about 3 months?
Yes, it was enough period. It wasn't like an overnight thing. It was enough period of time that it was in the press. You know, it was known that Ozzy had left Sabbath, and they got a replacement. and then realized it didn't work out. Although they did get some material from that, which Ozzy didn't want to sing on. So they rewrote some of it, and some of it they just told Ozzy they'd rewritten it, but they hadn't.
Hence the cracks are appearing.
The cracks are like canyons at this point, Mike, aren't they? So we end up in 1978 with the album called Never Say Die. If we thought Technical Ecstasy was bad, then this is not good, Mike, is it?
No.
Not good at all.
No, you got a little glammy stuff going on with the Hard Road. I would say probably on this album, jeez, I don't even know where we.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's any positives that we can pull from this one, Mike. You can kind of enjoy it if you pretend it's not a Black Sabbath album.
Yeah.
Again, foreshadowing, but it's kind of like they're trying to do punk and prog at the same time.
Yeah.
And it sounds like a poor man's Who.
It's not working.
Yeah, I mean, the best thing you could probably say is a bit of energy on the title track.
Never Say Die is probably, if I were to recommend anything from this album, it would be that song.
Yeah, but you don't. But just don't, folks. Just move on. I mean, Johnny Blade sounds like a bad Guns N' Roses B-side.
Just the name itself sucks.
I mean, that's a song called Johnny Blade should not be on a Black Sabbath. And but to me, its greatest crime is it sounds like a band that was influenced by Black Sabbath, not Black Sabbath.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it.
You know, it sounds like someone trying to be Black Sabbath. Sadly, it's Black Sabbath trying to sound like Black Sabbath and failing.
Yeah, and you know, you could tell, you know, they weren't totally into it. Like you said before, Ozzy was vetoing some of the songs that they had written with Dave Walker.
Yeah.
So I think it was like kind of a piecemeal album that they put together. And the title Never Say Die is kind of ominous because obviously following this album, stuff happened.
But it comes out, it doesn't sell well. They go on tour, with some up-and-coming band called Van Halen opening for them. And when you're struggling for energy, not really at the top of your game, a young and hungry Van Halen is probably not the band that you want to be going on after. Not in 1978 when they're the hottest thing that's coming up.
Yep.
So anyway, they finished that tour, and in 1979, Tony finally gets to the end of his leash with, or the end of his rope with Ozzy. I think just too many times of him being, you know, out of it in the studio, and just obviously all the drugs that they're all doing.
That and the focus on his side project with the Blizzard of Oz.
Yeah, so Ozzy gets fired, and although at this point they're still with Don Arden, Ozzy's living basically in a hotel in LA, and we shall kind of park the Ozzy story there and return to that later in the week when we'll continue Ozzy's story on its own track. But as far as his time in Black Sabbath, for now, is done. And Tony and Don Arden are wanting to get a new singer in, a guy called Ronnie James Dio, who has just been fired from Rainbow because of issues with a controlling and mercurial lead guitar player. What could possibly go wrong? But they get together, they jam. Because Ronnie is a musician as well as a singer, he could bring a bit more music to the table than Ozzy was doing. And obviously, which would, this will be hopefully news to no one. He is quite a good singer, would be one way of putting it, wouldn't it, Mike?
These top five for sure.
I mean, yeah, for me, you got to put him, yeah, he's top two, probably.
Probably top two.
But, and again, we shall return to cover Ronnie's career outside of Black Sabbath later in the week. But he joins Black Sabbath, much to the anger and disgust of Don Arden, who says, well, I won't repeat what he says, but it's not very complimentary about Ronnie, who is known for being a man of short stature, let's put it that way. But what isn't small is his voice and what he can produce musically. So yeah, Geezer leaves briefly.
Geezer was upset with losing Ozzy.
Yeah, losing Ozzy. So they get Craig, a guy called Craig Gruber, who was formerly in Rainbow, with the, obviously the Ronnie connection. And then Jeff Nichols, who was the keyboard player, would become the keyboard player for Black Sabbath permanently, fill in on bass. Geezer comes back. Jeff Nichols moves to keyboards. And they go into the studio and record an album called Heaven and Hell. And like just like that, with one bound, they were free. And suddenly we're back on track, Mike.
Yeah, how do you replace your very iconic singer with another almost equally, not quite as equally iconic, but would become iconic. But
yes.
And boom, he just jumped right in and completely changed the band.
Yeah, I mean, this if Sabbath Bloody Sabbath is their best album, Heaven and Hell is like kind of a close second for me.
As I mentioned previously, this is where I really got in on Sabbath, mainly because of Dio, because I became a Dio fan early in like 83, I believe it was. I bought Holy Diver with my confirmation money. But that's...
Is that an appropriate... Well, I mean, it is an appropriate use, Mike, but probably wasn't how it was intended.
So yeah, this is where I
It's on brand, back. Mike. It's on brand.
Yeah, right? I didn't tell my uncle, who is a priest, that's what I used my confirmation money for. But
anyway, yeah, we shall return to Holy Diver later in the week.
Yes, but Heaven and Hell is where I jumped in. And I just love everything about this album. From Dio's, you know, Rainbow and Wizards lyrics, which would later on come to annoy certain people in the band. But like Neon Nights, that's a banger to open this album.
Oh, it's just banger after banger, actually, Mike.
I mean, Children of the Sea, classic. The title track.
Yeah, the title track is just awesome. It's just, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's just it's a completely different sound because Ronnie, you know, I mean, this is not news to anyone, is just a vastly better, technically, a singer than Ozzy was. But, yeah. Anyway, let's just have a little bit of Neon Nights, because it's just so good. People got to hear it. If they're not familiar with this era of Black Sabbath, man, are they in for a treat.
We'll be right back.
Beautiful.
Just wonderful network, yeah. I mean, it's all, yeah, as we said, it's almost like it's a different band. You know, you've got the new wave of British heavy metal that is coming up at this point, and suddenly Sabbath come roaring back to say, hang on a minute, boys, we ain't done yet.
Yep, and Tony says that it, you know, about that time that they'd never been more prepared going into the studio.
Yes, and I think also, you know, he said, yeah, I think I alluded to it before, that, you know, because Ronnie was also a could play an instrument, he could communicate with the other guy, you know, particularly Geezer and Tony, in a different way than Ozzy could, you know. And then he could just do things like that with his voice. Yeah, it's like when in Maiden Week, when we went from Killers to Number of the Beast, and it's like, I think I said, yeah, and Bruce comes in for the first time, it's like, yeah, we're not in Kansas anymore, are we?
Let me show you how it's done.
It's like, yeah, Ronnie comes in, it's like, never say what, sorry? Erased from my memory. Just an absolutely, I mean, it's the fourth one the four that you could consider their best album, and therefore, by definition, in conversation, as one of the best metal albums ever. It's an absolute classic.
Can't say any better.
The only thing I would add, which is a nice little Easter egg, and people probably weren't expecting to be hearing about Cliff Richard on Sabbath Week, but here we go. But the song Lady Evil, in the breakdown of that, Tony clearly plays a little snippet of the riff for the Cliff Richard song Devil Woman. Obviously, Devil Woman, Lady Evil. The song title is...
I'm going to have to re-listen now. I did not pick up on that.
Yeah, it's the breakdown of Lady Evil, and then it's because that was a big hit song in the UK, Devil Woman.
Yeah, so, I think that was the only Cliff Richard hit here. Yeah. So I remember that as a kid.
And Tony's on record as having in his youth being a big, as a lot, yeah, loads of guys come up, guys like Richie Blackmore, Brian May, were big Cliff Richard and particularly the Shadows fans because of, you know, Hank Marvin's one of the first sort of British guitar heroes, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, Tony 100% would have heard that song that came out, I think it's, yeah, maybe 4 or 5 years previous. But, yeah, listen to the breakdown in Lady Evil, and then you'll hear the little, did it? The little riff to Devil Woman is there.
I think some of the Lady Evil, the feel of it, it's almost got that almost a little bit of a Southern rock feel that Ronnie used to do in his previous band, Elf. If you listen to some of the Elf music, it's got more of a Southern, you know, not quite Skinnerd or the Outlaws or any of that, but it does have like a Southern vibe to it. And I think Ronnie brought a little bit of that sound into Lady Evil.
Yeah, we'll keep our powder dry on that for later in the week when we might. But yes, absolutely. No, but yeah, Heaven and Hell, folks. Yeah, if you want to be like Mike Coley and start with Heaven and Hell, you can't go wrong. Absolutely, just great stuff. So they're back. Whilst it's not selling at the same level that the first sort of five albums did, it's still, you know, it's a much more of a hit and very successful. They go out on tour, and Bill finally quits sort of midway through the tour for the Heaven and Hell album, finally having enough. Now, we didn't mention the second time that Tony nearly killed Bill, but I think that happened, I think it was on the Never Say Die. It was either Never Say Die or Technical Ecstasy, I think it was the one where they maybe it was technical ecstasy, when they set fire to Bill, which is a thing they were apt to do quite often, apparently. But this time, in Tony's coke-fueled haze, they got some tape cleaning fluid or something. It was in the studio.
Yep.
And they start spraying it onto him. It's highly flammable, so of course he goes up like a stuntman, but without all the protective stuff, and parts of his trousers melt to his leg, and he's got bad burns and rushed to hospital.
And Geezer's mother even got involved with that.
No, Bill's mum got involved. Was Bill's mum phoned up Tony and basically threatened to kill Tony.
Yes.
what have you done to my boy, basically? It's funny because actually, in Tony's biography, there's an incident on stage where someone comes on stage with a knife and nearly stabs him. And he talks about how can people be so stupid to do such a thing? The previous chapter he's recounting where he's poured flammable liquid onto his drummer and set him on fire. It's like again, don't do coke, kids. Yeah, you'll do stupid things and you'll lose all sense of self-awareness. But anyway, back to 1980. So Bill leaves and is replaced by Vinnie Appice.
Previously in Rainbow, was he?
He was indeed
with Ronnie.
With Ronnie, yes. He comes in and sort of slots straight in. And I mean, he's a very different drummer. He's an excellent drummer, and technically, a inverted commas better drummer than Bill, but much more of a straightforward rock drummer. Doesn't have the same sort of swing and that looseness and jazz sort of vibe that Bill brought to it. But the band continues on, finishes that tour, and then heads back into the studio in 1981 to record with Vinnie now on drums, but still Tony, Geezer and Ronnie, to record Mob Rules. It's basically Heaven and Hell Part 2, really, isn't it, Mike? You would say, is that a fair description?
Yeah, it could be a double album, Heaven and Hell and Mob Rules.
It's not quite as good, I don't think, apart from the title track, which is probably, after Sabbath, Bloody Sabbath, probably my second favourite Sabbath song. I think the title track is just awesome.
Yeah, that kicks for sure. I love Sign of the Southern Cross, too. Just Ronnie's vocals and Sign of the Southern Cross.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I can listen to Ronnie sing anything, to be honest here. So it's just, you can't get tired of hearing it. But although the title track was recorded at John Lennon's old mansion. Do you know that, Mike?
I did not know that.
It was indeed, yes. There was all, there was all sort of, his former mansion. It was recorded, just the title track. The rest of it wasn't.
Didn't they record that for the heavy metal movie?
They did indeed, yeah. And it then it sort of became into the album. Slipping Away sounds a bit too much like a Zeppelin outtake for my tastes. Sort of part of what brings the album down a little not bit in my notch. But yeah, the title track is just another classic for me. So yeah, let's have a little blast of that and then we'll wrap up with there and move on to what's next. But
Ronnie.
His vibrato on when he says the mob. Yeah, rules. This is why you, oh, it's just so. But the thing is, Mike, when they were trying to react to punk in like Techno Ecstasy and Never Say Die, and they're trying to, oh, we've got to try and compete with punk. Man, just do that.
Yeah.
Because like, punk can't do that.
Definitely
it's
not.
Like, you know, it's like, it's got all the energy, but it's also just got, yeah, it's also got Ronnie singing it, and it just absolutely rocks, like, yeah. Like nobody's business. Just, yeah. Yeah, I do love that. I particularly do love the title track of that. I just, yeah, it's just so good. And just Ronnie's vocal, which is, they say.
Yeah, side one of that one is definitely right up there for me. Side two, I could, you know, like, it's good, but it's not side one. Side one,
yeah.
Side one, yeah, just,
it's a notch down. It's the album as a whole is notched down, but it's still excellent. It's still very good. It's still good stuff. Well, there we go, Mike. We've covered the second five, so we're up to the tenth. That's the tenth Sabbath album. And shall we? We'll maybe leave it there. Play it with a bit of "Sign of the Southern Cross" to send folks off to wrap up day two. And we'll return for day three and see where that story takes us.
Ta-ta for now.
Indeed. And as we mentioned yesterday, yeah, you can get us on the socials. You can leave us, email the pod, rocketsummerspod.com, to let us know what you think. Any Sabbath thoughts? So get me on Facebook, Stephen Routledge, and Mike, folks can get you.
I'm on Facebook, Mike Coley. I'm on Instagram at Swamp Rat. I also have the radio show every Saturday from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Eastern Time on Rockin' the Suburbs Radio, suburbsradio.com. The show is called Walking at a Suburban Pace, so check that out if you're so willing. And we also archive all our shows on Mixcloud, so if you search for RTS Radio on Mixcloud, you'll be able to find every show that's on the, mostly every show, that's on the Rockin' the Suburbs Radio platform. Check it out. It's good stuff.
Right, cheers, Mike. Well, let's Ronnie and Tiny and crew take it away with "Sign of the Southern Cross," and we'll speak to you tomorrow, folks.
Then how can I know what you might believe? A story told that can't be real somehow must reflect the truth we feel, yeah. Fade away. When it hears a certain song.